Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by James Davis. This time we are talking about something that is much better than Mercy, and I think both of our opinions, and we're discussing the first season of Castle Rock. This dropped July of 2018 was when the first episode hit, and it's a 10-episode season. But James, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm super excited to talk about Castle Rock because I feel like ever since season two ended, no one's talked about it. So I'm very excited to get this chance to discuss it with you.
Yeah, it's one of those shows that I think because it wasn't a direct adaptation of any one thing, a lot of people maybe didn't quite know what to do about it. I know at the time I was writing for a website and I was actually covering it week to week. And I was kind of like all over the place with my thoughts because they incorporate so many things. And obviously, one of the first big pieces of Stephen King IP that we see is Shawshank.
Very true. It's I would agree with you that it's really kind of hard to get into, especially since I just rewatched season one in preparation for this. The last time I watched it when it was airing. Always been a big Stephen King fan. Even I found it kind of hard to get into, because there are so many references. And then coming back to it, I kind of enjoyed it a little bit more because I knew what to look for. I'm like, oh, okay, so this is a reference to, the thinning between, where, Pennywise and stuff comes from. That stuff I didn't know before. And so, going into it a second round, I was kind of like, all right, I see where they were going with this universe. I really do love it, I think.
It's one of those things where it feels like they just got to play in Stephen King's sandbox and, Castle Rock being so iconic, it's not even that you're recognizing all of the places in Castle Rock because it's very much just like a neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. But everything they show us, the way that they filmed it and everything, it just feels like Stephen King's Castle Rock. It feels like a gritty version of it. It's a little bit rougher around the edges maybe than what we've had described to us in his books. I just think that they did a phenomenal job with it, filming in Orange, Mass and everything there, which I got to visit Orange, Massachusetts. I have a picture of me in front of that of the church that they filmed most of those scenes in there. So I just think it does a really good job of capturing kind of the unnerving feeling of living in Castle Rock and how there's always kind of something either around the corner or something that's happened in the past that can kind of affect the way you live in just this small town. And I think that Castle Rock really focused on that a lot with a bunch of really small plots, which is cool.
Yeah. One of the things I really love talking about when it comes to the adaptations are the cast members of these shows and movies, because in this, you have so many people returning who have already been in Stephen King adaptations. And, Bill Skarsgård, obviously the huge one. As Pennywise coming back, Sissy Spacek, the original Carrie coming back decades later. Love it.
Love her character.
Frances Conroy had been in the Mist TV show. Anne Cusack had been in the Mr. Mercedes TV show briefly. You just have so many people coming back to the Stephen King universe in this one. And I really love that because they're all playing very different characters than they play in all of the previous things they were in.
That's a very good point, especially with Sissy Spacek, because we all know Sissy Spacek is the Carrie. You can't take Carrie away from her. They tried once. It didn't work out super well. Sissy Spacek is very much just synonymous with Carrie at this point. But to see her in this role was so good. I think my favorite episode of the whole season is, episode 7, The Queen.
Yes.
The one where we get her point of view. And I just masterclass in acting from Sissy Spacek there. It's so good. Also, the actress, Melanie Lynskey, I've loved her for years. I think she's a great actress, but I think she was in some form of TV adaptation in a Stephen King universe.
Yes, that does sound right. I am totally blanking on which one it is. So I am looking it up as we speak, but also Chosen Jacobs from It. you know, he plays Mike and he shows up in this. So you have, again, just so many of these people coming back. And it's just so fun to see that, because to me, it kind of signals that, you know, they're already familiar with this. Rose Red is what Melanie Lynskey was in.
Okay.
Yeah. I knew it was like one of the like made for TV ones, not an adaptation of something. I was like, was it that one or the other one?
It was so random. It was a totally random one. And she was like a kid in it, I think, too. And so it was so cool to see, well, like to know Melanie Lynskey was like in, younger when she was in the Stephen King, and be like, that's a deep cut Easter egg. It's like, all right, she was on this made for TV Stephen King, but if you've seen that, you know her already, and she's been in the universe. So she knows what Stephen King is and she knows how to handle it.
Yeah, it is kind of wild how many people they had returning to this. And not to mention the fact that, you know, you have like Jane Levy playing Jackie Torrance, and she kind of says at some point during the season that, you know, she took the name Jackie to just kind of piss off her family and her real name's Diane. It doesn't really clarify if her last name is still Torrance, but, you know, she just makes the Diane comment and I'm like, okay, so she could still actually be related. And, you know, that never really goes anywhere. It's just like one of those fun things for the fans. But, you know, you also have Scott Glenn as Alan Pangborn, just all around such a great cast. And I know we haven't talked about every single person.
It's impossible to. There's so many good characters.
Yeah, because you have the different timelines. So you have the young Alan Pangborn, the young Ruth Deaver, you have the young Henry, the older Henry, and, you know, all of this. Yeah. Yeah. So many Henrys. All of the Henrys are in this.
So many Henrys. God, it is a hard one to keep track of at points because of that. There are so many characters. But I think all of the actors and actresses that were playing those characters, like Sissy Pasek and what was the name of the actor who played Alan Pangborn again?
Scott Glenn.
Scott Glenn, yeah. He did a phenomenal job as well. Really just an impressive cast just all around. Despite, like, even if they hadn't all been in Stephen King stuff before or, like, weren't even, like, knew about, like, what Castle Rock was about, then they killed it. I don't know. I think they killed it.
Yeah, and, you know, Andre Holland playing the lead Henry, I guess you could say. You know, he's been in so many things, and especially recently too. It's like people would probably recognize him from American Horror Story, Moonlight, A Wrinkle in Time, all sorts of things. And, you know, I forgot how good this cast was. I started rewatching it and I was like, oh, I love so many of these casting choices. Like, they're just so good. Even down to like the murder bed and breakfast couple.
Exactly. I loved that mini plot line. I loved it. I don't know. They really sold it. And it was just like a little bit of black comedy to throw in there to show like how much the kid can affect everything around him. And like, I don't know, you're right. Just the entire cast kills it. And it's so enjoyable.
Yeah, it really is. So to dive into the story here, you know, I watched this the first time and there were definitely some confusing elements to it, as there are wont to be for, you know, Stephen King adaptations and stories in general. But the fact that these were sort of all new stories kind of based on more so the town than anything else. And you have how the town is kind of in shambles and Molly's sort of the big name real estate agent, and big name in the facetious sense, because there's not a whole lot going on in Castle Rock, but
yeah, quote, air quotes around the big name in real estate.
Yeah. And she has like this drug problem because she's taking pills for these, you know, kind of headaches that she gets and this anxiety that she has. So you have this whole town where everyone is kind of just doing what they can to get by. And the people who were born and raised there don't want to leave for whatever reason. And then, you know, the big thing at the beginning is one, Dale Lacey, played by Terry O'Quinn, who we didn't even mention, you know, just driving off a cliff because, okay. And, you know, then we find out that the kid has been in this I think they call it a bear cage or a tiger cage or something, down in like the dark depths of Shawshank. And that is sort of the catalyst for the entire season.
God, trying to boil it down like that, it's so much happens. To your point, like, it doesn't focus on anything like from a Stephen King's like repertoire of books or movies that he's written and stuff like that. So it very much feels like we were given this show, which is an awesome representation of Castle Rock and like what Stephen King's town is like, but almost like we heard a rumor or a whisper in one of Stephen King's books, and that's what this story is. It's like, it's something from Castle Rock that we weren't supposed to hear, or like something that was like hidden around the corner with all of these other people that like live in the town of Castle Rock. It was very cool to be in the same footsteps as someone who just lives in Castle Rock. Like, didn't necessarily want to be dragged into any of this. And I don't think any of Stephen King's characters want to be dragged into their situations. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people in Castle Rock that just kind of live in Castle Rock. So it's interesting to, like, see Castle Rock operate just as a town and not as, like, a hotbed for evil and terror all the time. So we do get some of those points of views of just, like, a couple of characters who are just trying to live in Castle Rock and trying to carve out an existence.
Which is kind of what his novella Elevation does, because it takes us back to Castle Rock. We're focused on, you know, maybe five characters in that story, four or five characters. And, you know, some weird stuff happens because it's Castle Rock. But, you know, I think these came out around the same time, too. So that coincidence there is kind of wild because, you know, the lead time on the shows and everything, and the lead time on the novella, who knows when King wrote that. I think it was a more recent write.
Yeah, Elevation is one of the ones I haven't gotten the chance to read yet.
Yeah, I won't spoil any of it for you, okay. But it does take place in Castle Rock, and it kind of gives you a different look at the town. It's not like this big bad thing happens. It's just like about these people in this town, and you know, some weird stuff is going on. So that's very much what this is. And because the show kind of kicks us off in 1991, you almost think this whole thing's going to be about a missing kid, and then they find him like 2 minutes later.
Yeah, they really do set you up thinking that Henry Deaver being missing is just going to be like the main plight. Like, there's all these characters in 1991. We're going to have to find Henry Deaver. And then he's like right there, like 4 seconds later. And it's like, all right, so what's this going to be about? And so it really went off the rails there, and in a good way.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Finding the kid and stuff in the tube, but like beneath Shawshank and stuff. I think that was a great way of setting it up, because we got rid of Warden Lacey. We no longer have the answer to this question. And now we have to deal with it. It was a great, very King way of setting it up. Like, all these characters now have to figure out what to do with this one guy, because the one who knew what to do is just gone.
And then he is replaced by Ann Cusack.
And then she also just has zero interest in making Shawshank a better place, and more interested on like bringing down Warden Lacey, which is interesting. I guess it was definitely like a little bit of a scathing read of the American prison system there. There were definitely, it was not a subtle read at all, but they definitely wanted to point out that the American prison system is not the most well set up.
And because we haven't really seen a prison in this way since The Green Mile, and because The Green Mile and Shawshank both take place fairly far in the past, you know, this felt like an updated version of those stories without necessarily being entirely about the prison, but just the commentary on it alone. You were like, okay, this is what they're getting at. This is how they're bringing this iconic, you know, place from Stephen King's world into the present day. And you see it's in shambles too. Like, they have not taken care of this prison. Like, it looks almost as bad as it did when Red was there.
True. The fact that there's just a whole, it's the West wing, right? Or it might be the East wing. It doesn't really matter. But like the one that's just completely shut off from like the rest of the prison, they went over there. I'm like, you guys really just left this and just didn't touch it. Like, it's falling apart, and now you want to put people in here? You need an asbestos cleaner in there. This place looks awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that we expect prisons to look pretty by any means.
No.
But, you know, you shouldn't have stuff falling on you.
That's true. Yeah. Or, you know, like, the kids... prison cell there is a pretty rough prison cell. Like, it's not a very good prison at all. They do a really good job of making Shawshank look terrible. They do a good job of it.
Yeah, it somehow looks even more terrible now than it did when it was,
yeah,
like, you know, the 30s to 50s or whatever time period it was.
Yeah, somehow it aged even worse than it had already been in. So somehow that worked out. Who knows?
Yeah. So they find the kid and, you know, adult Henry comes back to town because we find out that he basically only works with inmates on death row. And then you have all of this history coming up while he's in Castle Rock. You know, he goes to the house, he finds out that Alan Pangborn's been living there, and he kind of always knew that his mom and Alan had this thing going on. And you see how hateful the town still is, you know, a good 20 plus years later towards him. And it's just like, man, you guys really don't get over anything, do you?
They get over nothing. Nothing at all. It's
And then we find out the truth that, yeah, Molly is the one who killed the dad. And you're just like, you're not even mad at the right person.
Exactly. It's so frustrating. And then everyone keeps blaming him regardless. Like, throughout the season, they're all just like, yeah, you know, this is definitely because you came back to town. And I'm just like, or it's maybe the fact that you live in an evil town. That could be it. Like, one of those things could possibly it. Who knows? But they just do not give anything up in Castle Rock, do they? They remember everything. They blame you forever. And then they just continue to treat you like crap until you leave the town, apparently.
Yeah. To be fair, King has kind of posed small towns that way throughout so many of his novels. So it definitely fits. It's just so unfortunate because you're also like, this is like the one black character in the entire town.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of painted Castle Rock as I'm from New Hampshire, so like it does paint Castle Rock almost as feeling as like, you know, one of those more northern New Hampshire towns, more northern Maine towns that would probably blame a black youth for something like this and just stick with it for like ever. So it did feel like a very, yeah, it's so weird to say, but it felt very New England for that to happen in a town like this that's so detached from everything else. It made sense in the, like, the modern day Castle Rock type of sense. And they even kind of, like, it even kind of pops up in it. Well, actually, it definitely pops up in it with Mike getting bullied all the time, but definitely something that pops up there in Castle Rock's history of having, like, kind of a bigoted history there. There's a couple of characters throughout King's work, I think, that point to that.
It's interesting because you see how much hatred is thrown Henry's way, and then, you know, his son Wendell comes to town and it's like no one really interacts with him other than Ruth and the kid. So you're kind of like, this is sort of strange. And then you have, you know, Odin who comes in later, and it's really hard to get a read on his character because it seems like him and his translator kind of stay off the grid since they're just driving around in a RV. And, you know, it seems like they don't really like live in town. So you have that whole different aspect. And, you know, we'll get into that in a little bit here. But Henry basically goes around and starts asking questions, which makes people like him even less than they already do. And, you know, at least with Warden Porter, she doesn't really have an impression of him, but she still, you know, has this push and pull with this character where she does not want to give this guy any information. And obviously that has nothing to do with his past in Castle Rock, nothing to do with his race. That has everything to do with her wanting to save herself basically, from any scrutiny, because all of a sudden this prisoner popped up who has no records. So she's kind of in this panic mode too. You don't really see her panic, but you know it's there because you're like, okay, everyone is trying to figure out what's going on and she's just trying to bury it. So you have that juxtaposition there. And I think a lot of this season just has so many little weird things going on too, because you have like this moment in episode 3 where we find out that Molly killed Henry's dad, and then she is like looking for more pills, and she goes to like this, I think they called it the Timberland Court or something. It's basically like this motel. Oh, yeah. And she finds these kids in these weird masks that are very similar to like the 2019 Pet Sematary masks. And you have this kid, Derek, who is selling pills, and he's actually also in The Mist. He was one of the characters in The Mist TV show. So, you know, it was just one of those quick things. He was literally like just in that scene and that was it. And you're just like, this is so weird. And it never goes anywhere. But you're still like intrigued by all of these weird things happening in Castle Rock that it keeps you watching, which I think was kind of smart, but also a little bit of a bummer that they left so many like open-ended things.
That's for sure. They left a lot that was like definitely open-ended. I would have liked to have seen a resolution for those, that kid's story, especially since it talked about how they had families that like worked at Shawshank or the factory and stuff like that. So these are like kids that are like gathering around this one teenager that sells drugs. Like, I would love to know more about how this kid came into this type of situation, you know, where he's like playing court with these kids and stuff like that to like keep them distracted, maybe, but we'll never know.
Yeah. I think they leave stuff open-ended with Jackie a little bit because they give us bits and pieces of her story, but we never really know like if she's from Castle Rock, if she just came to Castle Rock. And she makes that comment about changing her name in passing to the kid. And she has like this whole thing going on where she is kind of very nosy, you know?
Yeah, her whole thing is being nosy.
She tries to know everything that's going on in Castle Rock, which probably isn't super hard to do, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's just sort of like this mysteriousness around her character. And, you know, she kind of hangs out with Molly and is Molly's assistant, mm-hmm. even though it seems like Molly can't afford an assistant.
That was a really random job to have her do because, it did not seem like Molly could afford an assistant whatsoever.
And then she has like a taxi service too. It's like very weird.
She's got a taxi service. She works for Molly. And then she's also just like a murder nut. So it's all over the place. But I think, even how they finish Jackie's character, they don't even give her an ending. Like she's the last person we see on the show because she gets that mid-credits end sequence where she explains like, oh yeah, what better place to finish the story than the place where it all started, talking about going back to the Overlook to go and finish her book about her uncle going crazy or something like that. And I personally thought that was set up for season two. Definitely was not. Season two went completely the other way compared to The Shining and The Overlook Hotel. It was a weird place to end her story. We're like, yeah, she's going to the Overlook. And I'm like, and she's not coming back. So like, if she goes to the Overlook, she's not coming back. She's another Torrance like who just got left there. So it was a very weird way to end the season and one of the weirder like things that got left behind in the show. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have liked, I'm with you where I would love to have seen some more with Jackie and like get a reason for her being around a little bit more than just coming in handy at just the last minute, you know? Like,
yeah. Then you also have Odin who gets Henry into the RV and into the room where there is absolutely no sound so that he can listen to the schisma.
Yeah, do they call it like the filter or something? I think that's what they call the box. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he is dead. an episode or two later. And so I was rewatching this with my mom, and her theory is that because Molly knew where Henry was, she was the one who killed him. But at the same time, I was like, okay, if Odin was there, though, where was the boy who translates for him? Because they're like otherwise never seen apart. And it just felt like really unclear what happened there, because we don't see a struggle. We don't see him die. We just see him like shoved in between some like tree logs.
Yeah. And then later we see the translator for Odin like bleeding out on the floor of the police station. It's the last episode, I think. But like when like they're escaping from the police station and all those convicts escaped for the first time, then we see Odin's translator on the ground too. And I was kind of like, where did he even come from? Like, we're ending this plot line like right here in this police station, but Odin's been missing and no one even interviewed this kid that was like had to do with Odin, but now he's in the police station. That was a weird ending. I can see where your mom gets the Molly killed him theory, and I think that's probably what the showrunners wanted us to go with, but also it's just too ambiguous to give it that. It's just too ambiguous.
Yeah, because my thing was, you know, it's one thing to pull someone's tube out, you know, and a whole other thing to stab someone in the eye and move their entire dead body to hide it in the woods, you know. And even though Molly is not stable by any means, it didn't feel like something she would do, because she felt like she had to kill Matthew. There was just something compelling her to do it. And it never felt like she was just going to do that again for whatever reason.
And they spent a lot of time with Molly's character and her explaining that she killed his father, but she didn't really kill his father. Like, she does a lot of like, you, Henry, wanted your father dead, and so I in turn wanted your father dead. And she said something about how like it was my hand pulling it, but it was your hand behind it, or something like that. So there's a lot there for God, I feel so bad for Molly's character the whole season. They do that to Molly. I just want Molly to be happy.
They make more references throughout this to like the episode where Alan has his speech that he's giving in like the little town center park area, and Ruth jumps off the bridge. This is episode 5, I believe. And later she makes a comment about how nothing in this town stays dead. And even though it was not the same kind of dog, I imagine she was talking about Cujo, because the dog barked and then next thing you know, she like disappears and is standing on the bridge and jumps. And it wasn't something that they blatantly said. And because it was a different type of dog, it wasn't a giant St. Bernard. I think it was a big Rottweiler, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something that might necessarily click right away if you were kind of just watching and like, that's very strange. What is she doing? You know, because you're more focused on Ruth.
Yeah.
And so they did that. You know, Wendell comes in episode 6, and that kind of changes the dynamic a little bit in, you know, the Deaver household, because he's playing chess with Ruth. She's telling him things that she hasn't told anyone else. And you get this other side to Ruth that I don't think you could get with any of the adult characters in her life. You know, she wanted this to be a thing between her and her grandson, even though it was clear she hadn't really seen him all that often.
Again, credit to the writers of the show and credit to Sissy Spacek for just like writing such a good character as Ruth, because everything up to that point makes me think that Ruth would be like, you know, the world's best grandmother. Like, I think Ruth would be the world's best grandmother.
And then you have him showing her the like VR AR kind of game, and you know that she, you see her like tap the phone screen and she's all happy that she like killed the monster.
Tapped it. Yeah, and then she gets that little like smile and I'm just like, oh grandma, thank you. It's so good.
Yeah, so like those moments between those two were really good. And then, you know, we have episode 7, which is the queen, and Ruth is spending a lot of time in her memories. And it felt like a very visual representation of how Alzheimer's works.
100%. My grandmother's like actually going through like dementia like right now. So like getting to see that, like, hit a little close to home. It was really good to see, because I think that as much as the medical world understands it, that's how people experience it. Like, you have your memories, then you don't. You're in your memory, then you're not. Like, stuff like that. And I don't know. I just think it was a fantastic episode. It makes me cry. It made me cry the first time I saw it. It made me cry this time. As soon as I saw her explaining, I was like, oh no, it's that episode. And it was very sad. I thought one thing that was surprising with that episode, and not to be like a big downer, but I thought that she killed herself at the end of that episode. I thought that that's where that ending came from. I understood that by the end of it, she was in her memory of seeing Alan for the first time, but I thought that she had killed herself because of everything that had happened and that they were going to come in. And that's, it worked with the story that she didn't die, but I thought that that was how they were setting up the ending. So when we got to episode 8, I was like, oh, she's still alive. Awesome. Great. She's still here. But the way that it was coded, I was just kind of fully convinced until I started episode 8 that she had died and that that was the end of like her story. And I thought it would have been a good ending to her story. It would have been even more heartbreaking than her story already is. But that is one thing that ended up on my back burner in my brain.
Yeah, it's definitely easy to get that impression. But, you know, they keep her around only to have her then kill Alan the next episode. And it is so heartbreaking see her go through all of that stuff in episode 7 with her memories and then with the kid taking on more of Matthew's personality and memories and just being even creepier. And, you know, she sends Wendell out of the house and you have that death. Then in episode 8, you have the Juniper Hill fire and deaths, and there's just so much going on. And everyone who knows Ruth would know that she had absolutely no intention to kill Alan. So they pin it on the kid.
Yeah, that's for sure. Actually, this is a point I wanted to bring up. Like when you mentioned Cujo earlier and how she says that nothing in this town stays dead, is that was like my first theory about Castle Rock when I was like watching it was this, like, once we got to episode 7, was that the kid was Henry's father, like reincarnated into this body or something like that, or some sort of mind switch type thing. But definitely wasn't that, which was cool. It is easier to blame the kid because the kid just brings out the worst in everyone. It's hard to figure out what his deal is. And he can obviously bring out the worst in her because he knows exactly how her husband was mannerism wise and everything like that. I don't know. It's a very odd moment in the show when they like don't give it to Ruth. I think it's good, but also it is a very odd choice of everyone to make to not, like, I don't know, because Ruth obviously knows that she killed him and stuff. And even though she gets confused at certain points, she's very aware that she killed him. And she explains that she was scared at the time because the kid was chasing her and things like that, but not necessarily that things that, it wouldn't get her off of her murder charge. She would still have to go to prison probably, or at least like a nursing home where she's completely under supervision and stuff. And it was interesting to see the whole town.
Yeah. In theory, she probably would have ended up at Juniper Hill.
Oh yeah. No, you're right. Also, yeah, I was watching a video. Isn't like Juniper Hill like the only like psychiatric institute like in any of like the Stephen King stories? Like it's one of the only ones mentioned. It's like the only psychiatric institute in all of Maine, apparently. But yeah, that's exactly where she would have ended up. And it would have been heartbreaking to see Ruth end up there, you know?
And then they throw you a curveball with episode 9. We see this very successful Henry, who is the kid. And, you know, Ruth's story has stayed the same in that version of this timeline, or, you know, in its own timeline. And, you know, she's still suffering from the same illness, but she did leave Matthew and her and Alan moved out of state. So it's kind of like the what if storyline almost.
Yeah, it really is that what if version. It's a little brutal.
Yeah, because Henry is like in the medical field and obviously very, very successful in the same way that, you know, the first Henry we meet is successful because he's a lawyer. But then we see that kid Henry locked up. And it's like they body swapped almost or something for these timelines. And, you know, you mentioned the thinning earlier, and it's sort of like this portal between worlds almost. And that is, I think, where a lot of people got sort of confused with this if they haven't read like a ton of Stephen King stuff, because it is so bizarre and sort of inexplicable in a way that maybe not everyone would love if they're kind of just looking at this for like the mystery suspense sort of show that it does tend to be for most of it. And, you know, to just have that as the penultimate episode, you're like, oh, what are you going to do with this? And, you know, they put a lot of Easter eggs in this episode, like Claiborne Creamery. I was like,
I love Claiborne Creamery.
I was like, I see what you did here. Thank you for this. I love it.
It was so much fun. I also, like, every time I saw Molly's, like, real estate sign, it made me laugh. Like, live like a king.
Yeah. And then in that episode, they also basically switch the roles of Molly and her sister. The sister is the one who, like, made terrible life choices and is couch surfing with her sister and things like that. And you're just like, wow, this alternate timeline is pretty wild. And Castle Rock is thriving.
And Castle Rock is one of those towns that just got, like, flipped over into, like, one of the most popular New England towns, you know? Like,
yeah. And it's like, you feel bad, too, because you're like, this is what this town could have been. And you don't get that.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And this will probably factor into like a question you were going to like talk about with like episode 10 as like, is that Castle Rock even real though? Is like my biggest question is because we have this thinning and the idea between or schisma, whatever you want to call it. The show calls it a million things. So or schisma, I guess we can like land on. But it's described as like a thinning between like two dimensions or two different worlds, other heres, other nows, I think is how they explain it. Which is cool. But if you've like read Stephen King before knowing into it, you know that creatures come out of this as well. Like not good things, like not like another person from another timeline, but like full on creatures, things that can like read your mind and like project your fears or like feed off your hatred or stuff like that. And I think towards the end of the show, I leaned more into that the kid is the monster type of thing. And I kind of think episode 9 was like a fluke to get into Molly's head. Because if we look at that Castle Rock, like that's Molly's biggest dream, like to have Castle Rock like that because of her.
Yeah.
And to like have that story being told by quote unquote Henry Deaver from another timeline. Her knowing it, like, I don't know, it just felt a little too close to her almost being tricked by, like, this other Henry Deaver. And then there's the quick shot at the end of episode 10 where you see basically a White Walker from Game of Thrones, but, like, for a hot second. So I still am on, like, I think I finally landed where I think that Henry Deaver is the kid is a monster. I think the kid is a monster.
And we see young Henry in that scene with Molly and the kid, and she touches his hand, and it's like everything from the timeline we had been watching up until this point.
Oh crap, you're right.
Just kind of flashes back. So I do agree with you though that it's definitely kind of tied to Molly in that sense, because she's the only one who is going to be able to do this. And you know, yes, it is certainly like the most ideal version of Castle Rock for Molly, because we see from, you know, the beginning of the season how she has this grand plan to revitalize Castle Rock, bring more jobs, and we also see the prison close down at the end. So all of those people who worked at Shawshank, you know, 1 year later, Henry is still there. He's a lawyer. He's helping people out. And you kind of see after episode 9 some of Molly's dream coming to life in that year later moment, because you have more things happening. You have the prison shut down, which is, you know, even though it provided a lot of jobs, probably for the best because of what happened there. And then, you know, you have Henry going and giving the kid a burger, and he has like this little smirk on his face at the end, and you're just like, no, I wanted to like you, but now we can't.
Exactly. No, that's exactly what it was. I wanted to be on the kid's side the whole time, and I was ready to write Henry off as the villain at the end for putting him in the cage, and then we just get that little smirk at the end, and it's just like, how much did you know this whole time? Like, how much did you know? Like,
obviously a lot, because he makes a comment where if I stay here, bad things are going to happen. And it's like he wants to go back through the thinning. And we're supposed to believe that, you know, that's where young Henry went when he ended up in this sort of like other reality and ended up being kept in a cage. So you have this weird thing going on where it's like you don't know what's real because they gave you episode 9, and you're just like, wait, but young Henry came back and grew up, so how is he in a cage there when this other Henry is an adult? And it's like so wild. It makes my head hurt, admittedly. Like, I'm not sure I fully understand it.
Now that we're talking about it, I'm even getting to this other theory where I'm like, all right, so we were shown this other Castle Rock. We had this whole, an entire episode dedicated to this other timeline of Castle Rock and possibly it being real or it not being real. And I think it's important to note that we never get from, I'm going to call him Henry One, Henry Deaver One, original Henry, whatever you want to call him, is that we never get him actively remembering anything besides the cage. So we get this point of view told to Molly that like shows Henry with the cops as a kid and everything, trying to run back to the woods, being interviewed by Molly and everything like that. But whenever we're getting Henry's flashbacks, you don't really see Henry like anywhere except that cage, which makes me think that he could have been on the other side of this dimensional portal thinning schisma. And he could have just been in that cage in a dirt, like in a dirt basement, and it could have just not been Castle Rock at all. It could have been something totally different, and we wouldn't be able to know that because the only full story we have is from the person we can't trust.
Right. And, you know, Henry actually goes to try and figure out what happens to him, and he visits the Desharden house.
Yeah.
And we still don't really get an answer because the brother who lived there at the time is dead or in jail or something like that and not around. And the house is a disaster. And Henry just finds his police file there. And that's another thing that kind of just gets left and not really followed. And, you know, there's like a cellar outside, you know, a set of cellar doors or something. But it's never really clear if that's where he was kept when he went missing in 91. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, a lot of questions.
So many questions.
Not as many answers.
That's for sure. That was actually another, like, it's very, it's like tentative, like Easter egg for that house, but the DeHarden residence or whatever. When Henry goes back and is talking to Ruth, she was just like, oh yeah, something about old Nazis used to live out there. And I was just like, aft pupil. I was just like, oh shit.
No, it's just funny when you catch those things. And, you know, episode 10 obviously doesn't answer all of our questions, but because we see the kid back in the hole and, you know, Castle Rock is doing well, we're like, okay, everything has kind of been set right again, because Alan earlier in the season warns the replacement warden about letting the kid out. And, you know, he is just willing to not turn him back in because he says he can help Ruth, and he doesn't. And we see how that turns out for both Ruth and Alan. You have that moment too, where Ruth is back on the bridge and Molly finds her, and Molly makes a comment about one of the times you left Matthew. So that kind of makes us believe that everything that happened in episode 9 is sort of real. And then Ruth turns to her and is like, oh, you've never said that one before. So it was kind of like there's this multiverse of timelines or something, you know, and Ruth has memories of all of these times that her and Molly met at this bridge. And I'm just like, but this still doesn't really answer my questions.
Exactly. That's the main problem, is it's like, that's super cool. It just doesn't answer my question. That's a really cool thing.
To be fair, though, not answering all of our questions kind of left me wanting more. And even though I knew season two was going to be a separate thing and it was going to be like an anthology thing, and I don't know if they're ever going to do a season three, I do really love the idea of just kind of playing in Stephen King's sandbox with things like this. And
I think it's a great idea.
I was still really impressed with this show because it easily could have been something I hated.
That's for sure. I mean, with any Stephen King adaption, and as soon as you hear TV series, like after it, I almost get more nervous when it says TV show. I'm just like, okay, like he writes long books, but can you do it right? Like,
yeah.
And Castle Rock, I think, benefited just from playing in Stephen King's sandbox. Like, it didn't have to, like, appease fans of being, like, diehard fans of, like, the Mist novella or The Stand, like, which The Stand's a TV show now, right? I haven't watched it. Like,
both times, miniseries on TV and then a season of TV on CBS All Access, I think.
Gotcha.
This show just did a really nice job of giving us this different element to Castle Rock that we hadn't necessarily seen before. And it combined all of these things we were already familiar with, if, you know, we're avid King readers or watchers. And I really think the cast was so, so good, and it makes a lot of this work. And obviously we see that Henry has chosen to stay, and we see Wendell come back, I believe. And, you know, good thing he didn't listen to his dad and came back. Also, murder house couple gets murdered. You know, the husband gets axed in the head by Jackie. So much happens. I know we can't talk about everything, but James, do you have any final thoughts on this first season of Castle Rock?
My final thoughts are all questions. No, no, I love season one of Castle Rock. I loved it more doing the rewatch for this show. I think it's a treat for anyone who loves Stephen King. If you've read a short story, if you've even just a collection of short stories, because he's got so many that take place in Castle Rock. I think most people at this point are pretty familiar with the name, at least Castle Rock. And I think the writers, the showrunners, the cast, they just did an incredible job bringing the people in Stephen King's universe that were probably on the side for most of these stories, like bringing them to life and making it their story. And I don't know, I love this season. I really do. And I know both you and I are like, there are so many questions left over, so many things left up to interpretation. I remember being frustrated with the ending when I first watched it, and second watch through, now I really like the ending. I do like the ending a lot. It's a really good show. I recommend watching it. I don't think there's anything to lose from watching season one of Castle Rock. I think it's a well-made TV show. And if you like Stephen King, or even if you've never read a Stephen King book, like, awesome. Just an awesome show.
Yeah, I am a big fan of, like, weird, mysterious, murderous things happening in small towns. So this, you know, was like made for me, basically. And I think it's just one of those very interesting things that is a derivative work, essentially, but not in the same way that like the 11th Children of the Corn movie is.
No, that's very true. Yeah, especially the 11th Children of the Corn movie.
There are 11, I believe.
Are there really?
Yeah, one came out like last year.
Oh my god.
This year?
No way. You're like,
there's new ones. It's wild.
There's new ones.
I stopped after 3. I couldn't do any more.
I stopped out. I thought it ended at like 4. I know it kept going. I love horror movies too.
Yeah. So that's everyone's fun fact of the day. I know I've said that before here, but just to make sure that you all know I was serious about it. But James, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Castle Rock season one. It's been a blast. We probably could talk for like 8 hours about this show if we like really break it down, but that's a little too much.
If we kept going, it would go for another hour at least, for sure. But thank you for having me. It's been incredible.
Of course. And there's more to come. I'll be talking Castle Rock season two soon. So, you know, if you listen to this and haven't watched the show, there's probably still so much you could get out of it, even though we spoiled everything.
Don't let that deter you from watching this show. You're going to have your own point of view about this whole show.
And be sure to watch season two as well. All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.